I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues it faces every day, right here, right now, on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I've had a love of my own, hallelujah. I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Jean-François Rodriguez with us. He's the author of The Reluctant Mr. Mom. And at a very young age, his passion has been to write, and write some more. The author spent his early adult life switching from one job to another before deciding to go to the university as a mature student and build a career around the written word. Soon after graduating, his career as a writer took off with the publication of a number of articles in a national newspaper. He then honed his journalistic skills as a national broadsheet newspaper and major magazine publishing house. Now, the result of all of this work is The Reluctant Mr. Mom. His literary debut was the first in a series of titles based upon the years the author spent as a full-time house husband. And let's say, Jean, welcome to the show.
Good evening, Michael. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. The Reluctant Mr. Mom. There are so many people today that they just can't make that decision, but sometimes it's best to stay home, to watch the kids, to do what you have to do to get the job accomplished. How was that for you? Was that a different kind of a world than the one you thought to be so?
Oh, definitely so. When I became a house husband, which is now over 20 years ago, the term house husband was very rare. And there was still a very traditional view that if you're a man, you need to go out to work and earn the wage to look after your family. So the idea that a man would stay at home while his wife went out to work was something that people didn't sit well with people, and they didn't really like. And it caused a lot of problems for me, really.
Okay, well, when you say problems, was it socially? Was it something culturally that most people really didn't think should be so? Was it hard to explain?
Well, there was a lot of stigma attached, for starters. Sure. People felt that I was being lazy. I'd send my wife out to work while I'd be sitting at home doing nothing. My brother thought I was just a time waster. I mean, I got a lot of mothers thought me as being strange, a man staying at home looking after a child. It just wasn't a concept that was considered. Even when I was at school and I took workshop, neither my careers teacher, my workshop teacher, or my father said, when you grow up, son, you're going to be a house husband. It just wasn't considered. I always planned to be an engineer. My father was an engineer, and my great-grandfather was an engineer. So the thought of having to look after my son, a young baby, was really a frightening thought, and really I was in uncharted waters.
Now, but let me ask you this, John. What was the catalyst? Yeah. What was behind that decision for the two of you, yourself and your wife, to swap the roles?
Basically, my career was non-existent. I would go from one job to another. I didn't have a career path. My wife was a trained nurse. She worked for the National Health Service in the UK. So for stability and financial reasons, my wife was the obvious choice to carry on with her job while I stayed at home and looked after my son. It was purely financial and something that was logical to us.
You know, realistically, when you think about it, then you really, truly set that model, that male model up for your son. There's so many fathers that don't get a chance to do that because they can't spend the time to really build the bond and the relationship that moms do. And I think that in and of itself is a very interesting way to look at it. Now, if you were to look at your son today, and how old is your son?
He's 23.
Now, at 23 years old, if your wife had done that raising, the home part of the raising, do you think he would be different? Do you think he models more of you than your wife, or is he a good combination of both?
He's a combination of both, but he does, when it comes to his career path, funny enough, because now, since then, I've gone on to build a career in writing and so on, but he models me on his determination to do things. When I go for something, I'm very much like a bull terrier. I don't let go, and he models himself on that, and he does take a lot from me, and he sees my determination to get somewhere, and he does very much take his path from me. And I think if I'd spent less time with him, which unfortunately a lot of fathers do, have very little opportunity to spend with their children, you don't get that chance to build a bond. A lot of fathers miss out, and it's just a shame, a real shame, that men still think, perhaps it's changing now, that being at home is not a path that men should be been undertaking. It's something for the wife, the mother, and the man has to go out to work.
John, we're seeing more and more of that today. Now, you're calling from England, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Now, see, and the cultures in England and here in America, they're different, and yet they're the very same. Because if you take the home-based husband today, went through the same exact things, even in those years that you went through it. And that model of the husband goes out and he makes the money, and he's the one who brings, who brings it in, and the wife stays home and takes care of the kid, etc. It's the same thing. It's the same culture and the same traditions. And there's husbands who have to go through that. And I think in today's world, with the transitioning definition of what a woman is, that more and more husbands will probably stay home. Because if you hadn't have stayed home, you probably would not have been able to have the time to write and do what you really love to do.
Oh, definitely. I mean, when I look back at it, I mean, I was able to do so many things with my son and daughter. I was there to witness his first steps, to read him those stories in the daytime when he goes down for a small nap, take them to the park. I mean, unfortunately, my wife missed out a lot, and she did mention it a few years ago that she did resent the fact that I spent so much time with my children. But it was a great opportunity that I now cherish, and I would never change anything if I had the opportunity. I would always keep it the same. It's just one of those opportunities.
Now, by the way, when you have the ability to do what you do, and you went through the transition and all of the different concepts that people have had of what you should do or what you shouldn't personally do, even if they weren't living your life, what did you learn out of that? What was your takeaway? What is the gift that you get to walk away with?
Really, to know that I've built a bond with my children, that I've had an input into their lives. A lot of fathers, unfortunately, don't have that opportunity. I've had an input in how they develop as adults, and hopefully it's a positive input. Normally fathers sit on the sideline, and it's very much the mother who nurtures the child, who brings them up develops their character to help to be hopefully a strong and good person when they're an adult. And I think I've had a great amount of impact on both my children when it comes to developing their character and who they are today.
Years ago, I remember in an interview, I don't remember what the subject matter is, but I remember we got into the differences between men and women.
Yeah.
And Jean, what the woman had said was basically this: the difference between the two was lap time. And the girls were, moms would put the girls in their laps and they'd hug them and the stuff. And you don't do that with boys, quote unquote. And that was the difference. Interestingly enough, when you think about that, Now, do you have other children now? I heard you say children.
I have a daughter. She's 18 now.
Okay, now, with your daughter, was there, quote-unquote, lap time with her? Was there the bonding, the sitting in the lap, the holding, you know, the quote-unquote brushing her hair and so on and so forth that moms would do? Did any of that happen?
Oh, definitely. I had to take on the full role as if I was mum, from plaiting my daughter's hair to playing with makeup, all those things I had to undertake if I was going to really help my daughter develop. I mean, I remember learning how to do different plaits and how to style her hair. Or one day she wanted to practice putting makeup on, so I ended up with all lipstick and everything over me. And it was fine. That you just have to do those. Each child is different, and you have to address their needs. You can't just say, well, I'm a man, I'm not doing this. My daughter needed it. So it was, you know, you just fit into that role, hopefully, as good as you can.
No, absolutely. There's no question. I think one of the most important things that we are dealing with when we're dealing with, you know, family, mom and dad have their roles, but when you switch the role, you got to be mom and dad, and she's going to have to be mom. So you have to be both roles, and you could be the most masculine person in the world, and you're still going to have to do both roles. It's going to have to sit down and have lap time and be able to communicate with your daughter in such a way that she knows that this is what girls have, what girls do, and absolutely loved. Now, how did your daughter turn out? When I say how did she turn out, what was her experience of you being home instead of mom?
Well, my daughter, funny enough, is like a mini-me in her character. She's now doing writing. She's trained to be a journalist. I taught her to sing. I sing a lot. Her character is just like a reflection of me.
Okay. Now, by the way, the takeaway from the entire thing, I picked that book up and I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? Jean, what do I get out of the book that I didn't have before I read it?
Well, unlike many other books, which are a guide to this, a guide to that, my book shows my experiences as they were, what it's like to be a father or a man living in a woman's world, and what it's realistically like. I don't try and taint it with rose-colored glasses. I make it my experiences are real. This is what happened, the good and the bad ones. It's just a realistic experience, and for a lot of parents, I feel that it'll prepare them for what lies ahead.
I think that's absolutely great. John, do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, it's www.jfrodriguez, that's rodriguez.co.uk.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
Great subject.
Great subject matter. Okay, good night.
Good night, Michael. Thank you very much.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think
of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be.
Welcome back on Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Frank Sicari with us. He's the author of When the Wife Cheats. He's a native of upstate New York, and he's earned a degree in finance from California State University at Sacramento after serving as a military medic in the U.S. Air Force. Spent over 25 years in the high-tech industry holding positions from accountant representative to CEO, and for nearly 20 years now, specialized in turnaround management for companies under $100 million. And after becoming a single custodial parent after nearly 25 years of marriage, he left an industry that he loved to buy a small business in order to be home to raise his children. And he's currently the owner of an insurance agency, and he's in Sacramento, California. And let us say, Frank Height, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. When the Wife Cheats, obviously, this is it's a fictional story, but at the same time, there is a lot of your own personal self. It's got to be within the story. Now, this is something that happened to you. And
yes, sir, it did.
Yeah, and I'm not going to say just what happened, but the impact. How did you find out, and what was the impact of it? And more important, Frank, did you feel that you had a failing in anything when this occurred? What was that impact on you, and how did you respond to it?
The impact was devastating. It was when I had left the high tech industry and moved down to get into this insurance thing because I was traveling so much. I was involved in trying to get this business up and operational and get it working. I knew something was not right with the marriage, but I had no idea that my former wife had an involvement that went on for over 3 years. My children are the ones who found out about it. They were 12 and 17 at the time, and it was devastating to them. And then they kept this secret for this whole time. They never told me what was going on because it's not their role. It's not a child's role to do that. They did confront their mother when they found it, and were told that it's inappropriate, but she hadn't crossed any lines yet, and that she was going to end it, and no need to tell your father. And then it just went more and more underground, more password codes on phones and text messages, and things along those lines. For my children, it was absolutely devastating for them to have to keep this. Basically, this dirty little secret for a three-year window of time, and as the family continued to deteriorate, finally it got to the point where my youngest daughter discovered again that this affair had continued, had not stopped, and then that's when everything exploded, and she left the family. It was
Frank. Let me ask you this, and I think it's critical. What was missing in the marriage? No, there had to be something missing, some kind of a disconnect for either one of you to be able to go out and do something like that.
Obviously, there's never one side to any story. I traveled a great deal in the earlier part of our marriage. I was gone almost 3 weeks out of every month in my high-tech life. And then as we were starting this business, you're just gone a lot. You're gone probably too much. And from my end, that was probably the thing that was missing was I wasn't there as often as I would have or should have been there. And that, I'm sure, caused tremendous strain on my former wife. And situations come up, and one thing leads to another. And I can understand how it can happen. The length of time that it happened was a little difficult to handle, but sure. I do understand that things like that can occur. The idea, Michael, for the book came while we were in counseling. My daughters and I were in counseling, and we were in counseling for months. And as we're going through this, counselors started to tell me, you know, this is the first generation in the United States where it's becoming more common for the wife mother to leave the family. And they said in the past, if it was a wife who had the affair, it was usually the husband who would leave. And then they quickly added, we don't have a lot of detail on the impact of this on children, particularly daughters. And then I asked them why not, and they said because men won't talk. And I said, yeah, I can understand that, because I didn't particularly want to talk about it either. But as we were going through the counseling, an interesting thing started to happen. I started to get phone calls from men that I knew. So many of them were acquaintances, or one very close friend. And they told me, you know, how sorry they were, and how are you, and how are your kids doing. And then they said, you know, this happened to me too. And basically, this shocked me, Michael, because I had no idea this was happening as often as apparently it has been happening. I had thought I was the only one who was, you know, enough of a lousy husband that my wife not only left me, she left the entire family. And I brought this back to the counselors, and they said to me, you know, what you ought to do is start writing this down, because you have your story, and now you have 8 or 9 other men's stories. So why don't you find what the common threads were and write a book, basically highlighting these 9 characteristics that we had discovered as I started talking to people. The first one was, the people that I spoke to and myself, we're just average American men. We're not celebrities. We're not rock stars. We're not sports heroes. We're just guys. We get up every day. We go to work. We do the best we can to raise our family. To us, family is everything. And you do whatever it took, meaning traveling a lot, like in my case, or having second jobs, or you just did what you needed to do to raise your family, to provide for your family.
Frank,
which was a shock to me, was the length of the marriages of the people I talked to was 18 years. 18 years.
Frank, let me hold
you up. These people were invested.
All right, let me hold you up.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, let me hold you up for a minute, because I think this is critical to get to. It's germane to the issue here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And your story is critically important. The reason that it's important, that it lays a base of what occurred. This is not something academic. This is something you've been there, you've done that, you've gone through the challenges, the pain, the rest of it. I have a question. When you first got married, were you doing the kind of traveling that you ended up doing when she had the affair?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so
when
she knew what she was getting into. So, you know, I heard you call yourself a lousy husband. Not so. Because if you know what you're getting into in the beginning, then that's what you got. Now, if this would have happened 2-3 years after you'd been together, and then all of a sudden you're gone for 3 weeks out of the month, completely different story. So she knew what she had, and if she wasn't ready to accept it, she shouldn't have got into it in the first place. Anyways, that said, but it's critical that you go through this process, because with you going through the process in and of itself, then other people can relate. And it's like you said, your best friend, other guys, then all of a sudden they're going to bring to the table what never got brought to the table before. Now they're going to start talking about what happened to them. So,
yes.
Now, by the way, did she end up with this guy, or are they long gone as an item?
They were together approximately a year and a half after they left. And then, from what I understand, they are no longer are together. I don't have a relationship at all with her. So everything I get is through hearsay. So
yeah,
I'm not absolutely 100% sure, but my understanding is about a year and a half. That's also what we found with the other men that I had spoke to. The average length of the spouse who left and the lover in this case, the average length of time they stayed together was under 3 years. Which is, again, kind of shocking, considering 3 years is less than 5% of a normal person's life expectancy. And to do something to cause this much pain and devastation to family, and particularly your children, for something that lasts 3 years, because the hurt and the devastation of infidelity lasts forever, and you cannot ever fix that. You cannot fix that.
Now, by the way, let me give you my take on infidelity. If she would have married somebody else, the same thing would have happened. I think infidelity goes with the territory, quote unquote. I don't necessarily think that it is a cause after somebody's been together for I don't know how long, then somebody's going to decide to go off on their own and create some kind of an affair. So truly, when it really comes down to it, Frank, it would have been anybody that she would have been with would have went through the same thing. She took you on as you were at that time. She took you on as somebody who was only home 1 week out of the month. This is nothing new. This is nothing changed. So it couldn't have caused her, quote unquote, that much grief because she knew what she was walking into. And even if I have to repeat that for the next 10,000 times, I think the book in and of itself is extremely important. And one of the reasons that it's important is because you said it. Tons of people go through this. We don't hear it. The average guy, not the celebrity, not the family, it's just the family man. And the key is it doesn't matter whether it's for 2 years or 18 years that somebody's been together. They've got to find out that they're not alone in this and there are answers, there are places to go. And you said the words, I'm going to repeat it again. You said you were a lousy husband. I completely disagree and we don't even know each other. If there's a difference between if you, quote unquote, if, and I'm not calling her a name, but if you know somebody is a thief and you invite them into your home and they steal from you, you got nothing to say because you knew what you had walking in. If you don't know, there's a whole different situation. She knew what she had walking in. And if it wouldn't have been you, it would have been someone else in the same situation. If it would have been a different story and a different way to start the relationship, then the outcome could have been different. And if it wasn't, there'd be a reason for that. But she had it. She knew.
Yes, she did.
Yeah. Now, by the way, I wonder if she's read the book.
I don't know. I heard she'd heard about the book, but I don't know if she's read it or not.
We send her an autograph.
We have no interaction at all whatsoever. One of the things that we found interesting, Michael, and this is it could happen to anybody, is the planning that went into this, this extracurricular activity. On average, I found with the people I spoke to, the affair lasted approximately 3 years before the parties left. In 3 years, that's an awful lot of calculation that goes into this. You know, I can understand a circumstance or a random act that occurs and gets out of hand, but when something goes on for 3 years, then there was an awful lot of calculated planning to go on. I had one person ask me the question, do you think the internet or some of the social media had any impact on this? And I said, if someone's going to have an affair, it doesn't matter if they're on Facebook or anything else, they're going to have an affair. It makes it easier because you can change plans much quicker. In the old days, there'd be a phone call and a hang up and missed calls, and there were more signs. I wasn't looking for any of these signs. I think that's what happened to a lot of the men that I spoke to, is we weren't looking for any of this stuff. In the case of the people I spoke to, they'd been married long enough where they thought that bond and trust had been built and they were invested in, with each other. And it didn't seem to work out that way. The other thing that was very interesting to me, Michael, was there was a specific event that the couple was waiting to occur before they would actually leave the family, be it waiting for a job promotion or a teaching certificate or license or whatever the case may be, or for the man to leave the wife. Then when that occurred, that's when the separation went into motion. So from the act of betrayal from the men that I spoke to was just immense, that and to myself, it was just immense that this went on as long as it did, and it was so well planned. And when X occurs, then we're going to take off and leave. My daughters, having known of the affair and having been told that it was going to be ending, and then when their mother left, to them it was like the rug was pulled out from under them. They were devastated. They just didn't know, how could you do this, and how can this go on for as long as it did? I mean, the counseling sessions were invaluable, and if anybody's been in through this, talk to someone. Go to counseling. As much as most men don't want to do it, go to it. Just have that place, that safe place where you can talk and have this stuff out in the open and see where it takes you. Particularly if there are children involved, because it is so difficult for them. And then I ended up having custody of the children. They lived with me, And that became, again, from a man's perspective, is a very difficult thing to do because I was never a teenage girl, so I never had a point of reference on what they do and how they act and what they believe. And it took a tremendous amount of patience and listening and letting them vent. As a guy, generally your first reaction when you hear about something that occurs is you try to fix it. And you can't fix this. You just have to go with it and be there and be supportive and let, particularly if you have daughters in this case, let them go through all the range of emotions that they're going to be going through and just let them know that it's okay. And what their mother did or what was done to them does not have to define them. And that's what the counselors kept telling me, to make sure you get that point across, that this action does not define you as a woman. You can make your own choices. Learn from this. Does that make sense?
Absolutely it does. Now, but the question is are you going to be able to get into a relationship again?
Am I? I hope so. I never say never, and this hasn't soured me completely on being in a relationship again at some point down the road. Because my children were 12 and 17, my focus was with them to make sure that they were going to be okay, and we try to keep as much normalcy in our life as possible, keep the same routines as possible, not move and uproot them, and try to keep things as steady as it can be. My girls now are 23 and 18. One has graduated from college, one just started college. So now I'm at a point where I'm more open to having a relationship or dating or getting involved if the opportunity presents itself. It's a case of, it took a long time, Michael, to get into your mind, because many people I spoke to said, well, I hate all women. I don't want anything to do with women ever again. And I can see that being an initial reaction, but that's not the case. You know, not all women did this. Okay, this situation happened to me with this one particular individual. It doesn't mean that that's going to be the case every time. And the things that I heard in the counseling is, you know, you keep your heart open. Don't harden your heart. And when it's going to happen, it will happen. It'll present itself. So I'm hoping that that it does come again and that there is someone out there and I do meet that individual. But up to this point, it has not happened yet.
Okay. And if it does, obviously what I would do if I were you is I would tell this the next one up in front, everything right up in front, so there's nothing that comes as a shock. Because, you know, we're like this. You know, she smiled, that's the way she used to smile. And pretty soon we're in arguments with somebody that has nothing to do with what's going on now, but it's a throwback from the past. Now, by the way, I think the book is brilliant, and I think a lot of people need to be able to address this. So the question is, do you have a website we can find you at?
There is a website. It's my name, frankzaccari.com. Currently, it's available at Amazon.com. It's not in any bookstores yet. It's my first book, so we're still learning the process here. It was very interesting to write and put it together and relive the thing. The point that I'd like to leave everybody with, Michael, if I may, is while I hope this never happens to anyone ever because it's devastating, it does happen. It does happen. And you're going to find yourself, particularly men, when you're just absolutely in the depths of depression and sorrow, and there's going to be days when you don't have the strength to even get out of bed, and you don't know if you're going to be able to make it through the next hour, let alone be able to raise your children. And when you get to that point, and you will get to that point, someone told me, remember this at all times, look up, get up, and never, ever give up. You can get through this. It's going to be hard as hell, but you can get through this.
Yeah, no question about it. And that's really the key. It's called just keep moving forward, because if you get stuck and you get buried, you bury yourself, and it just makes everything more exaggerated. And this is not, you know what will happen? This is probably the best thing that ever happened to you, because next time around, it'll be stronger, more solid, and you'll know what not to get into.
I hope so. I hope you're right. I believe that's the case too. I think looking back, as I spend time with my daughters, they're much better and they're much stronger. And as hard as this was for them, they know what they want. They understand what occurred and that it can occur. And I am so proud of what they've become and how they've laid out the path for their life, even to the point, Michael, where when they did chat with their mother, which isn't very often, I understand, they have set ground rules. And these are the rules for our involvement going forward. And they said to me, it's not a case of I hate her, because it's not. It's a case of I will never forgive what occurred, and going forward, these are going to be the new rules and ground ground rules going forward in that relationship. And I agree with you 100%. I think when I do start getting involved again, when that does happen, to put all the cards out on the table, so there are no surprises, and this is what occurred, and you know it's in the past. The past is the past, and let's just move forward.
Frank, we're starting to run out of time. Again, website we can find you at?
Website is www.frankzakari.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Frank, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for the time.
Take care. Good night.
Goodbye.
So why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me. I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there?
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Rita Cosby coming up. She authored The Quiet Hero, Secrets from My Father's Past.
Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. Again, you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Rita Cosby back with us. She's the author of Quiet Hero, Secrets from My Father's Past. Rita Cosby is a renowned TV host, veteran correspondent, who anchored highly rated primetime shows on Fox News Channel, MSNBC. She's currently a special correspondent for the top rated CBS syndicated news magazine, Inside Edition. Honors for the Freetime Emmy winner include the Matrix Award, the Jack Anderson Award. She's also been selected by Cosmopolitan Magazine as a fun and fearless female. The list just goes on, and it's wonderful. Now, Quiet Hero, the book, culminates with her father's emotional return to his homeland, and we're going to get to that. And more important, or as important, not more important, through the book, Quiet Hero, Rita's partnering with the USO on a massive new campaign called Operation Enduring Care, which will help wounded warriors and their families. Book proceeds will go towards this $100 million initiative, as well as two museums in Poland, the Warsaw Rising Museum and the Museum of the History of Polish Jews, which is being built where the Warsaw Ghetto once stood. Hey, Rita, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Michael. Thanks so much. And perfect, too, as we lead up to Father's Day.
No, absolutely. My goodness. You know, every once in a while, when you look in the mirror, do you see your dad?
Oh, you know, now I very much see my dad. And, you know, he, as you know, he was not present in my life for decades. So this has been a dramatic turnaround. And I have the most wonderful relationship with my father now. It took a lot of bumps along the way.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, I have an amazing dad and an amazing hero in my own backyard.
Now, by the way, this kept quiet for many years, didn't it?
He did. And you know what? My dad, in my case, my father was twofold. You know, one, he absolutely was part of, you know, the most wonderful, greatest generation. He fought in World War II. My father was a Polish resistance fighter and a teenage resistance fighter at that, thrust into war at the age of 13, sitting there watching the, you know, the planes hovering above and suddenly getting thrust into World War II and staying and fighting, which is what's really commendable, because he's not Jewish. He could have left. He could have gotten snuck out of the country by his mother. And he said, no, I am staying and fighting for Poland. And so when you hear just these stories of what he went through and just the bloodbath that he went through fighting against the Nazis, I mean, they're incredible war stories. And just it's amazing he survived. 80% of his men did not. And so I think on one hand, my father went through such trauma and so much at such an early age that he truly blocked it out, Michael. I mean, he went from Ryszard Kozłowski, freedom fighter, to Richard Cosby, American, and barely ever spoke about Poland, barely ever spoke about his past. And when we were, you know, at the dinner table as a child, he would talk about these, you know, Poland and World War II like he read it out of a history book versus ever being there. He psychologically just put up this huge wall. And then on the other hand, I also think, you know, as I was saying, my dad is part of this sort of dignified greatest generation guys who, if you ask my dad today, here it is, you know, more than 65 years since he was in, you know, in the fight, he would say his finest hour was fighting for his country, and that he's not a hero. Everybody else, you know, those guys are the heroes. The U.S. troops who saved him, those are the heroes. And there's this amazing humble dignity about that generation where they just feel they were just doing the right thing and fighting for their country.
Now, by the way, he did something, or something happened to him that most people just hear about, and we see it in the movies. He actually was taken to a German POW camp and ended up weighing about 90 pounds, and he probably almost died there. Now, the nightmare escape, it was great. He got through and ultimately was rescued by American forces, and then obviously he ended up here. But most people don't talk about those experiences in POW camps that had to be absolutely horrendous, because if he was a prisoner in those camps, he wasn't a human being, he was a piece of meat.
No, you're right. He was treated as a number. And in fact, what started this journey with my dad was I discovered his prisoner of war tags in an old storage locker. I found this old suitcase in there. And again, my father left the family when I was a teenager, and I really didn't have a relationship with him at all. He was very emotionally numb, very unemotional and distant when he suddenly and very abruptly left the family. And so then years later, only recently, I discovered this old suitcase, and inside was that rusty POW tag. And in fact, when I first saw it, you know, I looked at it, and I had never seen a POW tag before. Here I am, a journalist, and I've covered war zones, but I'd never seen a prisoner of war tag before. And I looked at it, and I thought it was a POW tag, and it said Stalag 4B and the prisoner number on it, just like, as you said, you know, treated just like simply a number. And it's actually perforated, and it's a duplicate on the top and the bottom. Both say the same thing. And I went home and I went online and I looked up what it was, and it came up right away. Stalag 4B, one of the most notorious and biggest camps in World War II, German Nazi camps. And then the next line that really hit me, it said, if these two pieces are together, the duplicate of, you know, the duplicative pieces, are they, if they're still attached, you know, and not broken, that means the inmate survived. And it means that apparently when these inmates were starved or beaten or killed in the camp, they would break this number in half and shove one part in your mouth or tag your foot, and the other would go into the record books for the Nazis. So the fact that my dad survived and these pieces were together mean the inmate, my father, actually survived, as you can imagine, just hell and back.
Now, you know, one of the things I imagine for you and anybody who would go through this, you grow up, you're thinking your parents are a certain way. You know your mom, you know your dad, you think you do. And then all of a sudden something comes up, and this is not the person that you grew up to know, quote unquote. This is a completely different person. This is a person that has so much more depth than you could have possibly ever imagined. It had to be a bit of a shock to you.
Oh, it was so shocking. It was so shocking. And I hope that this book inspires everybody. By the way, the website is quiethero.org, quiethero.org, because if you haven't gotten a Father's Day gift, it's a great gift. It's a great gift to give any time. And again, as you mentioned, proceeds from the book go to wounded troops and their families. So it goes to a great cause. It goes, you know, it's a cause with meaning, too, and certainly a way to give back. And, you know, with my father and my father's case, and I've gotten a lot of people since the book came out where they've opened up too. And I think that's one of the most wonderful parts about this is since I've written the book, now I look at people walking down the street and I say, what's their story? Because if you saw my dad too, you know, here he is, you know, immigrant, came from Poland, you know, came to America, hardworking, became a civil engineer, and yet to find out that as a teenager he was this incredibly heroic resistance fighter fighting on the front lines, escaping through sewers at one point from the Nazis, you know, and then, you know, fighting, you know, tooth and nail with everything that he had, and then becoming a prisoner of war, and then, as you point out, escaped. And, you know, when you hear his story, it is so heroic and so inspiring, you know, the human spirit and the will to survive that my dad had, and also the patriotism. And when I hear, you know, I think of him, I think of also his comrades, and I think of the U.S. troops, because, you know, my favorite part of my dad's story, Michael, and I get choked up when I think about it and talk about it, as you pointed out, he was 90 pounds. And 6 feet tall when he escaped from POW camp. And again, he was fighting, frontline fighting, that sewer that he escaped from, you know, when he was surrounded by the Nazis, this was in the middle of the uprising. That sewer entrance was 100 yards from his house. I mean, he wasn't fighting thousands of miles away. He was fighting, you know, literally for survival of his neighborhood, his family, his country, everything. And so my father, you know, when he escaped ultimately from prisoner of war camp after that, again, 5 years of war, 6 months he's in a camp, he's starving at 90 pounds, and they break out, and he's in the woods for 2.5 days. And my favorite part of his story is they're in the woods, and you can just imagine, you know, it's scary in the camp, but you're in Nazi-controlled Germany. I mean, it's scary outside, you know? And so here he is, he's outside, and suddenly a plane comes by, and they dive for the ditches thinking it's a German plane, that this is it, this has got to be the end of it. And something is thrown out, and they assume it's a grenade. And again, they dive for the ditches again. And then the plane comes by again, and they look up, and they see a star. And they realize what was on the plane was the symbol of America, that it was an American plane. And what was dropped out was a chocolate bar with a note wrapped around it, tied with a red ribbon. And the note said, "Welcome. It's safe to walk now during daytime. There are no troops between you and our lines. You have 15 miles to walk, and you're free."
Wow.
At that moment, Michael, my dad just said he jumped up and down, and he cried. And, you know, I'm so emotional even thinking of the story. And and he said he was so happy, and they just ran 15 miles. Here they are, starving prisoners of war. You know, and ran and came up to a riverbed and saw these young American GIs. My dad was only 18 at this point. Again, 5 years of fighting, 6 months in a POW camp. He's still only 18 years old. And they came upon this riverbed to young American GIs on the other side of the riverbed. And they just shouted to him and they said, "Come, come, you're free, you're free, your nightmare's over." You know, and my dad said at that point, "I am coming to America." Because what a great country it is to send their young men thousands of miles away to save this group of ragtag Poles. What a great country it is. And that's why my father wanted to come to America. And that's why we did this book, Quiet Hero, because we wanted to give back and say thank you to the incredible, brave U.S. troops that saved my dad and I believe saved the world time and time again today.
Rita, one of the things that we need to really address, they say we as a country, as Americans, is exactly what you were talking about. When there is a problem, it's us that goes out to help. We're the ones that they call on, and a lot of that's been forgotten, and I think books like this should re-spark it again. I am so American, I squeak, you know, and I was brought up in the era when we didn't have a lot of what we had. It was before the 60s and all everything else that was going on. So I came from a different place. John Wayne is still my hero. Let me put it that way.
No, and he's my hero, too. He's my hero. And you know what? It is a great reminder of who we are as a country. Because, you know, it's funny. I've always loved the American troops. As a journalist, I've been out there, you know, covering them in all far-off lands. I've been in Afghanistan with them. I've been in many places and seen just the incredible dedication of our military and patriotism and sense of loyalty, you know, that my dad has talked about. And now hearing my dad's story, and knowing just what a huge, you know, just contribution that the U.S. military made in World War II. I mean, look, if they didn't step in, we'd be speaking German. They truly saved the world. And to think, you know, not just my father, but how many of these countries all over the globe where we save these people in a country that we may not know very well, we may not speak the language, and yet we put our men and women there in harm's way and time again do heroic, incredible things. And like those young men, you know, who are on the other side of the riverbed cheering my dad on, you know, for that I will forever be grateful. And my dad, too. And, you know, my dad specifically said, let's do this book. In fact, when I was working on the story, and it's called Quiet Hero, Secrets from My Father's Past. And I picked the title, and I sent it to my dad, the transcript, and you'll love the story. And I said, Dad, read it. This is before it got published. I said, if there's any problems or any issues or anything, I want you to call me right away. I can change it, you know, just if there's a wrong date or something. You know, you know the story best yourself, of course. You look at it and tell me. And he got it around 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening, and he stayed up all night reading the transcript, called me at 9 in the morning. And he called me and said, Rita, there's one problem with the book. There's a big mistake. And I thought, what did I do wrong? And he said, I have one huge problem. I said, what is it, Dad? The title. You called me a hero. You called me a quiet hero. I'm not a hero, Rita. It's not me. The troops who saved me, the American troops who saved me, those guys are the heroes. My comrades, the 80% of my men that did not make it back, those are the heroes. I'm not a hero. I was just doing my job. And I had to argue with them, Michael, literally, to say, Dad, it's my book, not yours. I'm calling you a hero. Can I decide on the title myself, you know? And finally he acquiesced and let me do it since it's my name as the author, you know?
Well, Rita, when you come down to it, one of the signs of a hero is somebody who says, I'm not a hero.
Oh, absolutely. And to me, those are the most incredible people, the ones who, you know, like my dad, you know, just believe that they're doing their job, they're doing the right thing, and humble about it. And you know, and after all this that my father went through, Michael, if you ask my dad, here he is now 85 years old, looking back on his life, and my father, if you asked him what was the finest moment of his life, what was the most important moment of his life, he would say the best moment of his life was fighting for his country and fighting for freedom, and that if he had the chance, he would do it all over again.
Now, by the way, I have been following you for a lot of years now, and there's something that's in the press release that I want to say because this is what I've seen through my eyes. It says, because of her extraordinary journalism and exemplary service on behalf of her community, community is country, any way you look at it, October 11th, 2010, was officially named Rita Cosby Day in the state of New York. Now what I got to say about that is if you watch what you've been through, or you know, the places that you've been and what you do, you're your dad. It's the same thing.
I'm humbled to hear that, because if I'm 1/1000th of my dad, then I'm doing okay, you know? And I think, you know, it's funny, I probably got, now that I look back, Michael, it's funny, as I was doing this story, I look back on some of the lessons my father was teaching us early on, and, you know, persistence and hard work and a lot of these great values that I do hope I carry over in my career and the way I treat people. I learned a lot of that from my father. I mean, my father really, when we were growing up, you know, not teaching us any of these things that he went through, but just teaching us good basic things. And also, you know, clearly here was my dad. Material things never mattered. You know, I talked about this in the book, that at Christmas time, you know, it would not be a gift. You know, he would say, do a poem or write a story or spend time with us. That's what matters. And I learned, I think, very good values from him early on, not knowing that he grew up with not any material things. And that was surely what he learned to survive with.
Rita, how do we, the public at large, how do we get involved in Operation Enduring Care?
Oh, thank you for asking, too. And it's been the greatest gift of my life and my father's life to now be able to give back and say thank you. And if you want to get information, the USO website, there's a great website they have. It's USO.org, and it's Operation Enduring Care. It's a terrific program. And, you know, when we were out there putting the book together, there was no question that my father and I wanted to do this as a thank you to the U.S. troops. And the USO is an organization I've been working with for years, for decades, and they do such tremendous work, Michael. Amazing work all over the world. I mean, we know about them entertaining the troops, you know, all the way back to the Bob Hope days. But in addition to that, they also have this new program called Operation Enduring Care, and it's specifically to build two huge facilities for the most severely wounded coming back from our current wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, and also, you know, from obviously past wars, too, as well. But these are new facilities that are being built to treat some of the most severely wounded so they can also spend time with their families. And it's a huge initiative. They're trying to raise $100 million. But I wanted to, I felt, to put our money and to be able to help where it's most needed, and especially those brave souls coming back from frontline battle and their families, I felt was really, really important. So if you want to get information, you can go to the USO.org website, find out about Operation Enduring Care. You can also go to my website, which is quiethero.org. quiethero.org, and just by buying a book, a part of the proceeds will go to U.S. troops and their families, and separately than that, also you can just find out information on the program. All of that is also on quiethero.org. It's a great book. It's become a New York Times bestseller, which is a wonderful thing, and most importantly, you can give back and honor our great troops, and I think men and women reading the book will like it. The guys love it because the action is great, and the gals love it because there's a great love story of a daughter and father in there, too.
Wonderful. Hey, Rita Cosby, thank you so much for joining us, and I really appreciate the time you spent with us.
Oh, Michael, thank you. It's wonderful to be with you, and happy Father's Day to everybody listening out there and you.
Take care. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yes, me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Major Mayor Eisenstein. Why do I always do that in the very first? I'm going to do it all over again. This is Michael Ray Dresser.
Oh, my dear friend, Michael. Let me say, you can call me anything you want. It makes no difference, you know.
Well, I don't know why, Mayor. Every time I go to do this intro, I fall right out of my mouth. Mayor Eisenstein,
you know,
with it.
You know, Michael,
yeah.
I've got two really important medical studies that were done this week, and a warning also. And this really fits into something we've been talking about for weeks and weeks about the HCG program, which essentially is a very low carbohydrate diet during the HCG part, and a very low carbohydrate, and but also you can add some healthy fats during the maintenance phase. And this is a study that was sponsored by the National Institute of Health and the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. Low carbohydrate diet may reverse kidney failure in people with diabetes. Now, let me tell you how impressive this is. I've only known that for 40 years. And so, you know, it's like, not that I'm that smart, you know, but we've known that. Researchers from Mount Sinai School of Medicine have for the first time determined that the diet specialized in high-fat, low-carbohydrate may reverse impaired kidney function in people with type 1 and type 2 diabetes. They also identified a previously unreported panel of genes associated with diabetes. So they go on to say, our study is the first to show that a dietary intervention alone is enough to reverse this serious complication, which affects tens of thousands of people with diabetic kidney failure. Now, so what do you think their conclusion is, what they're looking for? I'm going to give you one guess. Well, what should they do now that they know this? Should we go to the grocery store and eat healthy fats and very low carbohydrate? Do you think that's their conclusion?
No. No.
You're 100%. You are perfectly right. Listen to their conclusion. Knowing how the diet reverses kidney problems will help us identify a drug target and subsequent pharmacological intervention that mimic the effect of the diet.
Oh, good. So we're going to take a pill.
We're going to take a pill. Is this not crazy? I mean, I couldn't believe it. You know, it's like I said, oh, my God, finally something that we've known for a long time, that that this whole healthy carbohydrate phase is most probably going to be going by the wayside. There's no such thing. You have to shop the outside parts of the grocery store. You don't buy anything essentially that's the inside of the grocery store. It's got to be, you walk a big circle on the outside, and that's where you have your fruits, your vegetables, you know. But I couldn't get over that, you know. I mean,
it does nothing more than shore up our need to rely on the pharmaceutical industry, because when we're sick, they're going to give us a pill.
Yeah, and this goes along with the Food and Drug Administration this week updated an ongoing safety review of Actos. Actos is a drug that's given for people who are diabetic to help lower their sugar levels, and they found that if you take it for 1 year, it has increased risk of bladder cancer. Now, does that mean if you take it for 1 day short of a year, it's not? Or if it's 2 days short of a year, you know, give me a break. But let me tell you how backwards we are. Let me see if I can find it here. I can't find it. The print's really too small for my eyes right now. Based on the results of the study, France has suspended the use of Actos, and Germany has recommended not to start any new patients, diabetics, on Actos. Are we that backwards right now, though, that France and Germany make more sense than we do?
Absolutely. And one of the reasons for it, and I'm going to give it you, you know, we're going to go back to square one, which we always end up doing, is that somebody's going to make some money out of it. And as long as somebody's going to make some money out of it, it does not matter how it affects the health of the country, the nation, and the world. As a matter of fact, when we take a look at the pharmaceutical industry today, it's not just run here, it's global. And we have to look to...
Oh, it's global, right.
Yeah, we have to look go ahead.
Yeah, no, and let me tell you something. It's not only global, but, you know, I'm wanting to know why this interests me so much. You know, I was blessed to have found this HCG program. I mean, it's been around, but it's really been in the minor part of medicine for the last 50 years. And some of the findings that have been coming out in the last few months, that we've treated now over 1,000 patients, and we have essentially reversed diabetes. We essentially use the same diet as they're talking about here, very, very low carbohydrate. And that means apples, grapefruits, strawberries, salad, and even when you're talking about vegetables, you're talking about, and then we're talking about someone who's got disease. No potatoes, carrots, pasta. Well, that's not a vegetable. You know, none of the starchy vegetables. Now, I'm not saying these are unhealthy, but someone who's got diabetes who can't metabolize any type of carbohydrate or which is sugar type products, they have to be on a low, very low carbohydrate diet. And the incredible thing is it will reverse kidney failure. I mean, this is one of the most dreadful things to have, you know, a kidney failure. That means the ultimate, you're going to die from it. But even more, until you die, you're going to be on dialysis. You're going to be hooked up to machines, you know. And here it reverses it. I mean, what more do you have to say? I mean, this is not Mayor Eisenstein saying it. This is a study funded by our government.
Yeah, but it's also run, Mayor, on fear, okay? It's fear that causes people to move towards allopathic medicine. There's nothing wrong with allopathic medicine, chemical medicine. Obviously, there is a place for all of it in a certain spot, but it's not the be-all, end-all, and I think that's what people are becoming aware of today. It's not the very last ditch effort to do this. And I'm going to go back to what I said. I hate to be repetitious, but somebody's making a profit.
Exactly. It's not repetitious, you know. But let me tell you something. This is what your grandmother knew and my grandmother knew and our grandfathers, you know, that you eat stuff that's fresh. You don't eat stuff out of cans if you can avoid it. You don't eat stuff that has a shelf life. The minute it has a shelf life, that means it's really most probably not real food, you know. And here I just can't get over how blatantly ridiculous this is when we have the means. And I really believe the whole country has become diabetic. It's just a matter of degrees. Some of them will require no medication. Some will require some of the oral medications like Actos that will give you bladder cancer. And some are going to require insulin. And the only way to reverse this is by eliminating almost all the – it's more than just junk food. It's most people in this country can't even have oatmeal for breakfast because our system has been so ruined that we can't process any type of carbohydrate.
Now, by the way, when you were dealing with that, there is something that when we deal with supplements, et cetera, I have found and have been at the mercy of it in the last week or so, and over a period of years when I've got into health and I've got into the dynamic of how the body works and as it affects your entire life, that with supplements, you've got to find out how much your body can take. And I really believe in my heart of hearts, and you know I'm not a physician, that it takes blood tests first. And then those blood tests are going to tell you where you're high, where you're low, and what not to overdo. Because if you overdo something, it's going to cause some kind of a problem. I recently amped up on L-arginine and creatine. Arginine opens up the blood vessels, and in the creatine, it gets the entire system kicked off because I wanted to do a heavy-duty week or so of bodybuilding. And I did, and I felt when I did the supplements about the fourth time, I felt this little bit of a burning sensation when they went down. And then I didn't pay attention to it, and I let it go, and then I stopped taking them. And they ended up for about a week with a burning sensation all the way down from my throat, down into my chest, almost to the stomach. And I really believe it's probably the supplements, but the point of contention is it's how much do you take, and because we're all so different, how much do you take, and how much do you, when do you know when you're going to OD?
It's really a very good point. I mean, we can go back to King Solomon, who said that everything has to be in the right time and the right amount, you know, and too much of something is no good. Too little of something is no good. I think that's an absolute absolute point. You know, I mean, you're right. I mean, that's. But I got to add one more thing that's really fascinating about the very low carbohydrate diet, or maybe the HCG that accompanies it. I started noticing myself personally, and my wife Karen, my daughter Jenny, and Jeremy, the four of us from our family who've done this, that. I used to think you have to go to the dentist at least two or three times a year to have the plaque removed from my teeth because it would just build up. And it would, almost a year went by, and I forgot. I haven't gone to the dentist. I'm just so busy. And I look, I've been looking every day, but there's not a zero plaque. I go to the dentist. He's mayor. This is the first time I've known you for 30 years. I've never known you not to have plaque on your teeth. Karen doesn't have it. Jenny doesn't have it. And now I'm getting reports from hundreds of patients that say on the program, and essentially the program is once again a very low carbohydrate diet. And so I had a cardiovascular surgeon who came to talk to me, and I said to him, if there's no plaque on the teeth, do you think it does the same in the coronary arteries? 100%. If your body doesn't build plaque on your teeth, it's not going to build plaque anywhere else. Is that interesting?
Yeah, and no question. So if it doesn't build plaque on your teeth, you don't have to worry about it in your bloodstream, and you don't have to.
And
worry.
Even more, it's obviously resolving it, or it's, you know. And he thinks that he felt the same way, that the carbohydrates in our diet, you know, are what's causing almost all the heart disease in this country.
Yeah, no question about it. And I truly believe that to be so, because when you really come down to it, if it creates the plaque creates the blockages to the heart. And that in and of itself is costing the American population, the citizens here, hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions a year, to get it fixed. And all you have to do is not eat certain foods.
Right. And essentially, you have to stay away from all the junk food. And even some, and if you do that from the beginning, I'm guessing, you can most probably have some oatmeal and things like that. But if not, you have to literally understand that your carbohydrate intake has to be virtually zero. You know, see, we've grown up to believe in the last 30 years that carbohydrates are the fuel that fuel us. And for years, they believed to run marathons, you have to do carbohydrate loading before the marathon. All that's been shown to be not true. You know, that it's absolutely not true. And we've grown up with the idea that eating fat is what creates our problem. And it's had a bad name because we associated the fat in our body with avocados. And we're talking about healthy fat, the fat in the meat, the fat. That's not unhealthy fat. And Dr. Atkins understood this real well. He just didn't understand one thing, that once you reach a critical point, it takes more than just eliminating carbohydrates from your diet. You have to also have massive calorie restriction to get your body into a less fat state.
By the way, it is understanding the dynamic of the body. And Mayor, what's going on today is more and more people are beginning to understand that what they take in, and it's not just it doesn't do plaque. It's the dynamic that causes it not to. And
right.
it's as simple as something happens when you smile. Something happens when you frown. Something happens when you get hungry. Something happens when you're not hungry. And it's all a chemical reaction in the body based on what you take in, what you see, and what you feel at the moment.
I have this week, or no, about a month ago, I saw a very lovely Asian neonatal intensive care nurse. And she's short, and she's about 30 pounds overweight. So she's not a lot overweight, but that's not her biggest problem. She's a severe diabetic requiring insulin, and her blood sugars in the morning run over 300. And no matter what she's done, she hasn't been able to control them. They're giving her more insulin and more insulin. And being of Asian culture, rice is a major part of her diet, you know. And I said to her, I said, I'm not saying rice is a bad food, but in your case, you most probably aren't going to be able to handle it. And so she starts the program. In 2 weeks, she's lost 8 or 9 pounds. That by itself is just spectacular. Her blood sugars are normal after 10 years of abnormal blood sugars. I mean, it blows me away even.
Sure.
You know? And she can't, her insulin needs are almost gone, you know. And so I said, you aren't going to be able to eat rice the rest of your life. So what? You're going to be healthy, maybe something else. You're going to eat, you know, fruits and vegetables. My feeling is that before she was overweight, for whatever reason it is, we don't have to look at high fructose corn syrup or whatever. Before she was overweight, she could handle the rice. But the minute she got overweight, it somehow had a chemical reaction, the carbohydrate, that didn't allow her to be able to do this. It's incredible.
Now, if I come into your office, can you check me for allergies? Can you check the kind of food that I'm allergic to? Is that possible?
Let me tell you something. We have some tests that we do. We do something it's like acupressure type of machine that looks at that. It's not none of the allergy testing is very, very good. But my daughter who does the testing, Jenny, the nurse, she said, you know, Dad, if you tell people if they have any allergies, stay away from wheat and dairy. That takes care of 90% or 95% of all all food allergies, you know. That's why it's so, and you can see it's getting worse and worse in our society. Now children are allergic to peanuts. I mean, I blame that on vaccines, which carry so many toxins and chemicals in it. And that may be some of the cause of our obesity in this country also. It's hard to know, you know, except we know that anyone who's allergic, if you stay away from all wheat and all dairy, the overwhelming probability is most of your problems will go away.
Well, and the only thing that I don't want to hear is you got to stay away from coffee. I don't do drugs. I don't do most of anything, but I don't smoke. But my coffee, that would kill me.
Let me tell you something. I got something for you, because I don't like coffee. I just happen to not like the taste. I'm going to Panama in the middle of July to visit with a doctor who set up a nutritional clinic in Panama. She's an American doctor. She found this incredible piece of property there, and they grow their own organic, natural coffee. I'm going to bring you some back when I go. They said, Mayor, I said, I don't like coffee. It's a waste on me, but I have lots of friends, including Michael, I know, who like coffee.
Oh, absolutely. But I got to tell you, just to make it you feel better about this, the coffee's organic.
Oh, knowing you, I knew it would be. But I'm going to pick it myself if there's such a thing. I'll bring the cocoa beans home. You know.
No, I love every second of it. Mayor, we're just about out of time. Website we can find you at?
Homefirst.com. That's HOMEFIRST.com. And we've had our web designers have been working for a week. And they just got up our website. You know, we've redone a lot of things. And we're running a big Father's Day sale on vitamin D and everything, you know, over the weekend. And so wishing everyone a happy and healthy Father's Day. And once again, homefirst.com. If anyone needs any vitamin D, it's going to be, I don't even know what it is, but it's going to be a very good sale.
Good. Okay. And I'll talk to you next week. I'm waiting.
Oh, be well, my dear friend. Okay. Be well. Have a wonderful weekend.
Good night.
When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see, why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Science, Vienna, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. T.S. Wiley with us, co-author of Lights Out, Sleep, Sugar, and Survival. And T.S. Wiley and Brent Formby, that's a PhD, was co-authored. They're researchers who work together at the Samsung Medical Research Center in Santa Barbara, California, the site of a cutting-edge diabetes research since insulin was first synthesized there in the 1920s. T.S. Wiley is an anthropologist and medical theorist with a background in investigative journalism, currently working in medical research with a special interest in endocrinology, evolutionary biology, and let us say, T.S. Wiley, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we deal with that, I would venture to guess if you ask most people how important sleep is, you would get a very interesting answer. It is, T.S., it's very critical that we sleep enough, isn't it?
Well, yeah, in America, it's always been a cultural assumption that if you snooze, you lose. You know, the more you can stay awake, the stronger you are, the more money you'll make, the better your life will be, when exactly the opposite is true.
Okay, so now you go out in the night on the town, you eat all the garbage you can possibly eat, and then you don't get enough sleep, you're up there for the next day. What's the possibility of you getting sick?
Well, your immune system works while you're sleeping at night. So if you want to kill those germs, if you want to slow down those viruses, and you never let your immune system turn on to do that, Yeah. Instead, you use the other half of your immune system the next day to kill you, the autoimmune half. So now you've got asthma, and now you've got arthritis, and now you've got lupus. You're living your life backwards. You end up with all kinds of contagious disease and the disabling part of being, you know, hormonally bereft, arthritis and backaches and sciatica and, you know,
and all the
allergies.
Good stuff with it. Go ahead.
I'm saying that's where those allergies come from. You know, everybody wakes up itchy.
Yeah. And by the way, when we really come down to it, just a little bit of concentration on what we eat before we go to bed, a proper night's sleep, and maybe how do some of those power naps in the afternoon sound?
Well, power naps in the afternoon are a very interesting idea because cross-culturally there's this notion that, for example, siestas in Spain exist and people nap. But in reality, a very famous book written about napping about 10 years ago, people don't nap. You can't make melatonin in the middle of the day. Siestas are getting in out of the hot sunlight. People don't really sleep. They, you know, you just don't stand outside in the middle of the day because it's too hot. In reality, they might rest or they might read or they might whatever. You count sleeping, you time sleeping, and you time the endocrinology or the hormonal effects by how many hours of sleep you get before midnight, how much darkness you're exposed to. So whether or not you go to bed at 8:30 or you go to bed at midnight is what matters. It has to be a seasonal timer. So, for example, right now it's getting dark, 8:30, 9 o'clock. That's called summertime. So we have a totally different hormonal milieu in this season than we would in winter when it gets dark at 4:30 or 5 o'clock. So the hours of melatonin you secrete before midnight time, the rest of your hormones for the next 24 hours.
Okay, let's break this down so we make sure everybody gets this out there. You've got a central nervous system and you've got an autonomic nervous system. Central nervous system, that's your conscious activity in the waking state, that's your reason, your logic, your willpower, you make decisions, it's all there, frontal part of the brain. And then you have the autonomic nervous system. That's the system that controls your heart, your liver, your lungs, your digestive system, your heart. Your heart's beating. You're not thinking beat, beat, beat. This automatically goes on. And these hormonal changes that you're talking about happen in that unconscious system, quote, unquote. And it's not something that you're consciously aware of that you say, I need some melatonin or I need some of this. It automatically happens based on what your body needs or isn't getting or you've used up, quote, unquote. And most of that comes from an area that you're not consciously aware of. And the way to do things about it is sleep properly. Do the things that allow your body to create what it needs to do to be able to live a decent life. Are we close here?
The automatic pilot that you're describing is being controlled by the environment. The hours of daylight and the hours of darkness are controlling the autonomic nervous system, the automatic pilot. And that automatic pilot will then secrete the hormones that control neurotransmitter effect, immune effect, all of the things that are supposed to happen because you evolved on a planet that's spinning 1,000 miles an hour under your feet in and out of the light in a 24-hour period and then chasing the sun another 67,000 miles an hour, you know, in a year around the sun. Put those timers in you to do things normally. We changed all that when we invented artificial light, when we started to grow food out of season and save it so we could have carbohydrates all year round. In other words, we're supposed to have one period of long light and high carbohydrate intake, and that's called summer. That's one trip around the sun. That's the insulin clock. Well, we do that all year long. That's like four summers to stay up late and eat sugar all year long. So you're really clocking 4 years to one in this modern culture. That makes you age in fast forward. When you do that, you use up all the sex hormones that you started pouring at puberty. So inside, when you're supposed to be 20, you can be 80. You can be 60. You can hit menopause or andropause in your early 30s instead of at 60. Am I making sense?
Oh, absolutely. All right. Okay, let me ask
you. Okay, there you go.
Okay, now let me ask you this. And this is a habit that I'll bring it personally. This is a habit that I've had for the past 150 years now, if not longer than that. I live alone, so I go to bed, and I probably go to bed about 11, 12 o'clock every night, if not more sometimes. And the TV's on. I have music playing, but there is still light in that room. What am I doing to myself?
What you're doing to yourself, if the light is on, is taking 2 days to one. You have a false trigger on. Your body doesn't know what the light's on, particularly if the light is over your head. The pineal gland registers that as sunshine. If the light is to the side of you, like a lamp, if you were reading, that wouldn't be as devastating to your central nervous system, to your autonomic system. If the light is in front of you, like the television is on, that's pretty bad because a computer, a television, an iPhone, those all have a sub-detectable pulsing. You know, that little blip, blip, blip that you can't really see, but that's happening. That's so devastatingly addictive that you can't turn it off. It's a dopamine response. So when you take 2 days to one, now we've passed the point where the sun went to sleep and you were supposed to, too. So now you're into the next day. 2 days to one comes off the end of your life. So depending on how your group dies, maybe it's a heart attack. Maybe it's cancer, maybe it's Parkinson's, maybe it's whatever. You're using up dopamine, so we'll talk about Parkinson's. If your group is subject to having the substantia nigra, that little black spot in your head that makes dopamine wear out, you're going to wear it out twice as fast. So you might get Parkinson's like Michael J. Fox did in your 40s, for example, where you wouldn't have gotten it until you were in your 60s because you wore that out. You took 2 days to one. And it's
okay, but let me make sure we got this because I think it's critically important that the audience hears it in this way, that daylight or non-daylight, if it's black 24 hours a day or if it's light 24 hours a day, no matter who you are or why you are, those mechanisms in your body are waiting for a certain time for it to be dark and a certain time for it to be light. If you coordinate, if you are homeostasis, if you're in balance with those times that you should be sleeping, you should be awake, then you're okay. But if you're not, your body is reacting, and at 8 o'clock, at 9 o'clock at night when you're supposed to go to sleep, quote unquote, just pick a number, and you don't go to sleep, it is affecting your entire metabolism, and it's also affecting your internal time clock. And that internal time clock is going to basically tell you how long you're going to live or how long you're not going to live. So you are affecting your life's end quicker or shorter or longer based on how you stay in sync with the way your body automatically is responding to the world around you.
Yes, you come into the world with enough hormones for X amount of daylight hours, X amount of dark hours. That means you come into the world with those hormones. So you're going to use up more of those daytime hormones if you stay up late, and you won't have enough of the dark time hormones to balance it out to keep you healthy. And the problem is when you use up too many daytime hormones, you age faster. Then you use up too many of the sex hormones for reproduction, so you become infertile faster. We see that a lot now. Infertility is a huge problem, even in people who are relatively young in their 30s, who should still be fairly fertile, and they're not. And more than quality of life, we know that when you don't stay up, or when you don't go to bed, when you stay up, you wake up and you don't feel well, because when you change the melatonin secretion before midnight, in rebound, it'll come back in the morning. When it comes back in the morning because you didn't have enough the night before, you wake up as though you've been drugged. You can't wake up. You're groggy and you feel like somebody hit you with a sledgehammer because you have melatonin pouring. Where when you have enough the night before, you're up, you're alert, dopamine can pour, and you're fine. So the compensatory mechanism, when you don't have enough of the right hormone in the right space, is it'll come back the next day. The same thing happens with a hormone called prolactin. Prolactin was named where it was found in breast milk, but in reality, prolactin is a survival hormone. It's wherever there's food. So prolactin certainly is in breast milk, but prolactin's also in prostatic fluid, you know, that goes with the sperm. When a man ejaculates, there's a lot of prolactin in the ejaculate from a prostate because the sperm need a little lunchbox so they can go out for 3 days, do the job. You know, they've got some sugar. Prolactin is the hormone that controls your appetite for carbohydrates. So when melatonin is 3.5 hours, you have 6 hours of prolactin afterwards in the middle of the night. It also controls immune function. And we're all good. When you have less than 3.5 hours of melatonin before midnight, you have 1.5 hours of prolactin. Having that little, it'll come back the next day. Well, that's fine. That's a summertime phenomenon. So you pour prolactin all the next day, so your immune system is turned on, so you want carbohydrates, it's mating season, all of that is good. However, we all, you particularly, having described to me your schedule, are soaked in prolactin all day long every day. Because for you, it's mating season every day. You go to bed at midnight. And the problem with that is it will give you erectile dysfunction. It will make you autoimmune. It might give you asthma. It might give you arthritis. And it'll give you an appetite for carbohydrates because when you want a midnight snack, it's not going to be a string cheese or a hard-boiled egg because in your head it's summertime. So you're going to want wine or cake or some carbohydrate because it's endless summer in there, right?
Okay, so if you realign your sleeping pattern, and, you know, there's times when I've seen, I don't know how many ads with supplements with tryptophan, melatonin, take, you're able to sleep, so on and so forth. Is that replacing what you're missing?
No.
Okay, so...
No, it will help you sleep. Yeah. It will help you sleep. In other words, if you take, for example, Trader Joe's, free commercial here. Trader Joe's makes 0.5 milligram chewable. It says melatonin. I would let it melt in your mouth. Never swallow a hormone. I'm going to say it really loudly to everybody. Never swallow. Rub it in on your skin, let it melt in your mouth, and never swallow because it gets changed in your stomach and in your liver. So if you let this melatonin melt in your mouth, you know, one tablet per hour of darkness before midnight. So, for example, right now there's about 2.5 hours, so if you took 2.5 of these, they would knock you out because you would make that much. But the kind of melatonin that would go on during the night, you're not really going to make because your brain is probably broken from not sleeping so long. What you do need to do is watch the sun go down. The spectrum changes of blue to pink to black causes a change in the hypothalamic activity of all your hormones. So you watch the sun go down, get in bed within an hour or so of sundown, get up in the morning and watch the sun come up from black to pink to blue. You do that 3 days in a row, you're back in time sync. One of the problems about going to sleep at midnight is you can't go to bed if you didn't get up. You're not tired enough. So it takes about 3 days of watching the sun come up and forcing yourself up to be tired enough to go to bed, and you would be surprised at the remarkable changes in not only how you feel, but you'll look about 10 years younger too. And you can put yourself back in time sync and spin with the planet in 3 or 4 days. And I understand that it will destroy your social life, but you can time and tape television programs. You can turn off all the electric gadgets. You can put them in another room and just, you know, just say no. Do a Nancy Reagan. Just put it down. And quality of life will change significantly, as well as your blood pressure, your appetite, your weight, your memory. It's kind of cool.
Now, by the way, you know, you've watched on TV, you've got these Viagra commercials and the rest of it and so on and so forth. Do they in and of themselves have any of the prolactin in it? Is that what causes them to work?
No, you're being exposed to prolactin. Changes that and insulin resistance, which causes subclinical hypertension, which narrows the vascular beds in the penis, which causes the inability to have a full and strong erection. So insulin resistance, subclinical hypertension, prediabetes, plus the prolactin and low testosterone, all of those things contribute to midlife erectile dysfunction, which ultimately contributes to, I would tell you, cardiac disease and heart attack.
Well, it's all blood flow.
Yeah, it's all blood flow, circulation. Yeah. But what I'm saying to you is they're going to give you angiotensin blockers, ACE inhibitors. They're going to give you Viagra and Cialis, which are oxytocin and nitric oxide changers. I'm going to tell you that if you went to bed and the prolactin that was controlling that entire scenario changed, erectile dysfunction would change with a little testosterone supplementation. Right now, I did Lights Out, which we're talking about sleep. I did Sex, Lies, and Menopause, which talks about hormone replacement in women. I'm working on a book called Manthropology, How Modern Life and Medicine is Killing Men. And, of course, it touches on sleep and hormone replacement for men. So the issues of prolactin in the daytime and ED, which has been branded, erectile dysfunctions in there. Yeah. But mostly when men can't salute the sun anymore, when you don't wake up with morning wood, when you can't impregnate somebody, you're on your way off the planet.
Yeah, but you know what sells hundreds of millions of dollars of Viagra? Do you know what really sells that?
What?
The last statement in the commercial. If it lasts for more than 4 hours, go see your doctor. That's what sells it.
You mean everybody wants more than 4 hours?
Okay, T.S., we're just about out of time. Do you have it? And by the way, thank you so much. It's been wonderful having you on.
I had a good time, too.
Do you have a website we can find you?
I do. You can find me at www.thewileyprotocol.com. So, WileyProtocol.com.
I may never be able to do a show again. I'm not going to be awake.
Sorry about that.
Darn. Thanks, T.S.
It's always a personal choice. I tell people what I know, so You can work the knobs and dials to stave off extinction.
No, I think it's great. Okay, T.S. Wiley, thank you so much, and I really appreciated you.
You're welcome. Talk to you soon.
Yes.
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Paul Straub with us. He's the author of My Odyssey, Short Stories from the Life of Paul Straub. And think about this. We all dream about going on stirring and dangerous adventures. But Paul Straub, called by some the real life Indiana Jones, was praised, as astronaut Buzz Aldrin said, as the epitome of the independent, self-made man. Has done those adventures all over the world. He's one of 17 people to fly solo around the world, which he did in 1977. And he's traveled on every continent except Antarctica. And he's climbed Angel Falls in Venezuela as part of his first successful expedition. That was in the middle of a rainforest. He was inexperienced climber at the time, but he did it. He went into the middle of the prison riot to administer medicines. He's an adventurous, also a plastic surgeon in Los Angeles. Paul, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. What causes somebody to want to do these things? I think it's great, obviously. There's so many people who don't have the wherewithal to just go out and live and do it and not be told, no, you can't. And, you know, we live vicariously through people like yourself. What was it for you that caused you to have the kind of life you have?
Well, I'm a believer that anybody can do anything they want to if they put their mind to it, for one thing. And then I also feel that we live in the moment itself. What the most important thing is the moment. It's not the past. It's not the future. You have to, every single time you think, am I right now doing exactly what the very best thing in my life? And then I also feel that you're responsible for your own actions, too. They're totally responsible for my day and my feelings and everything. I never blame any other person or any other circumstances. So now, I had a very unusual life, and I never publicized anything. As a matter of fact, I even avoided publicity. But I'm not getting any younger, Michael. I'm now 39 times two. And I never publicized. My children had no idea what I've done. But I led a very unusual life before I had children.
Now, by the way, as a kid, were you this way? Or did this just happen as you became an adult? Were you like this to a
well,
much
I
less?
Did a lot of things very... The first thing is that I started working at age 11, and I continued. I put myself through college and medical school, paid my own way, working my way, and finished with no debts. So that by itself is unusual, to put yourself through medical school and work your way through, and end up, they end up with hundreds of thousands of dollars of debts to pay off.
No question. And I think that's something that happens to so many kids. They get involved. They don't quite understand what money is. And by the time they turn around and look, they're so far in debt they can't see straight. And it affects that career that they're going on. Now, if you were to talk to a youngster today, if you could get them to sit down and listen to you, what advice would you give them?
Well, a lot of people have read my book. I wrote it because I'm going to disappear, and nobody ever had any idea what unusual things I had done. And many people have gotten, tell me they've gotten some inspiration from it. There's no question on that. I tell them, I describe all of the very unusual adventures that quite unique. You've named some of them. And then I tell them about my philosophy of life, as I told you here before.
Now, by the way, I think an adventure in and of itself, to live in Southern California today, I was brought up there, and it has changed, Paul. It has changed so drastically. That in and of itself is an adventure.
Yeah, let's tell some of the listeners some of the things that we did. One of the first was that we went down to Venezuela. The Angel Falls is the world's highest waterfall. It's three times the height of the Empire State state building. It's 20 times the height of Niagara Falls, and it's in the midst of the jungle. It's exceedingly hard to get to, and the first unbroken drop is 3,280 feet, and so that's three quarters of a mile almost. Now, people had attempted to climb it. Two previous climbing parties with good quality climbers had climbed, and there's an overhang in the top 400, you know, 3,000 feet up, and then you have to go under an overhang 400 climb up. Two attempts had not succeeded, and they were experienced climbers. But I was with a group. I had very little experience, but I certainly had three very experienced people with me, and they pulled me up. So we were the first people to ascend the face of that. And that was, of course, was quite unique because other people had tried it. And then the other thing that is, a lot of things are unique in here, but the other thing was that I bought myself an airplane for $12,700. Most people pay more than that for your automobile. And then I totally did the airplane over and painted it, did the upholstery and new engine and so forth. And then I flew it seven times across the Atlantic Ocean. And then for a topper, I circled the globe. And as a single passenger, just circled the globe. That is the right across the Pacific Ocean. From the longest flight was from Honolulu to Des Moines, Iowa. It took 27 hours and 20 minutes, but I still had 2 hours of fuel. But Chicago was the airports were closed below instrument conditions, so I landed with still had 2 hours of fuel. These are all unusual things, of course.
Paul, let me hold you up. Because I think it's important. What was it like being up there? What was it like being up so long in that plane and looking down at a world that everybody was going about their busy lives and doing whatever there was, and there was nothing beyond the office or the job or the something? What was it like being up there? What kind of a sense of freedom was it?
Michael, flying in general, private flying is wonderful. You fly around and you look down at the automobiles and they're all in the traffic jams, and you cannot think what it's like just to do private flying at all. Now, it's quite interesting. If you're going to fly, for example, I flew from Australia across, landing at Fiji Islands, landing again in the Pango in the Solomon, and then on up to Honolulu, and then across to San Francisco. But it didn't stop at San Francisco. It kept right on going. Now, when you're midway between Honolulu and San Francisco, you are the furthest distance that anybody can ever be from land in the world by yourself. And now you have a four-cylinder engine going putt. And you're 1,000 miles from land. Now, my airplane did not have a 1,000-mile range until I put the extra tanks in, of course. So you'd be if you had a full tank of gas, you couldn't reach land in any direction unless you had the extra tanks along. It's quite a thrill, Michael.
Well, I imagine that it is, and I think what's more than that is that experience of freedom that most people will never get in an entire lifetime. You're sitting above it. There's nothing below, no matter what's going on politically, the educationally, whatever the case may be, culturally, you're above it. Nothing is affecting you at that moment, and it's got to be a place where you can really get some very clear thought.
How well said. You're completely correct. This is the idea of private aviation in general. It's a wonderful feeling to be able to get up and to be above everything. We drive around in two dimensions, and you've added a third dimension to it. How correct that is, Michael.
Yeah, and realistically, and I think that's what it is about, there's so many people, and I'm glad you're telling your story, because there's so many people who would never experience it. But if it's said in the right way, there's so many people who could live vicariously through your stories, and the things that they could never touch in their entire life all of a sudden become open to them only because they can see it, they can feel it, and they can imagine what it could be like. Because if I've never been up there, which I haven't, and if I listen to you, I can almost see myself through your eyes. And that's really what an audience is about, making that kind of a connection. And that, I think, is a wonderful gift for so many people.
I agree with you, Michael. I agree with you. Are you a pilot?
No, I'm not. But I just felt it through what you just said.
Oh, yeah, you would love it. Anybody. Now, you have to take it very seriously. In other words, it's not like driving an automobile. Minor errors can cause you take your life, forgetfulness. So you treat it quite seriously, but it's a wonderful feeling, yes.
Paul, I hate to do this to you, and I could talk to you all night about this, but we're out of time. Can we get a website where we can find you and buy the book?
Yes. If you go to, there are several things. My website for the book is myodysseybook.com, and you can buy it through the website, and you can also buy it amazon.com, and what you have to put is My Odyssey Paul Straub, and they have it, prices, also Barnes & Nobles and Borders also carrying the book.
Wonderful. Hey, Paul Straub, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care. Good night.
As they say in this biz.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling. We're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening.